Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 160 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm or download the MP3 after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast aggregators. You can also listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing 701-719-0990. Remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I'll send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand. If you'd like to help this show financially, you can go to infectiousmyth.com/donate.php for one-time donations or patreon.com/infectiousmyth for monthly donations. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests and your financial support. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. And now let's get to this week's long interview. Greg Lovett is a 30-year veteran of the television and multimedia industry. Originally from the U.S., Greg began his career as a director of live sporting events for professional teams in Houston, including the Astros. After relocating to Holland, Greg managed his own production company, creating television programs for both Dutch and international broadcasters. He was one of the founding members of Europe's first pay-per-view entertainment service, supervised the creation of Holland's first broadband internet platform, and spearheaded the development of digital programming for a variety of cable and satellite program operators. He's now back at content production and has spent the past 2 years producing and directing the award-winning documentary, Delay, Deny, Hope You Die. Welcome to the show, Greg. Let's start by first telling us, what are the burn pits related to the American military overseas?
Well, a burn pit is basically a dump. When the military invaded Iraq and Afghanistan, they didn't really give a whole lot of thought to what they were going to do with the garbage that was created by putting in these huge military bases. Each soldier produces about 9 pounds of garbage per day on the battlefield. So you can imagine how much waste is created when you've got 10, 20, 30,000 people living on these little fortified cities.
Right.
But what the U.S. Central Command decided to do, in all their wisdom, was to dig these big holes in the ground and throw all the garbage into it. And when I say all the garbage, I mean literally everything, from paper, plastic, rubber, metal, spent ammunition, old medical supplies, up to and including amputated body parts. Literally all the garbage that was created on the base was thrown into these big, huge pits.
And how did they get all the stuff to burn?
They ignited it with jet fuel. So they created these huge fires, some of which were burning literally 24 hours a day and producing this huge black plume of smoke that would just hang over these military bases. Some of the soldiers I talked to spoke of ashes that were literally falling on them all the time. They had to go out and, you know, when they were done working, going back to their barracks, they'd actually have to dust themselves off and take showers because they would be covered in the ash. It wasn't like a little secret fire or a fire that you actually had to visit or go into to be exposed to. It was something that affected the entire base, the living quarters, the work areas, and it was something they were exposed to 24 hours a day. It was just this poisonous, toxic, black plume of smoke that just hung over the base constantly.
How far away were the burn pits from the bases?
Well, they were actually on the base itself, so they would sometimes just be a couple hundred feet or a couple hundred meters from the living quarters. I mean, they were just right there. Some of them were huge. In some areas, you would actually have to drive to it, and it would be the size of several football fields. So it was just a gigantic dump that I kind of remember going to with my parents as a kid. We would take our garbage to the dump, I remember.
Yeah.
It would still be located on the base itself.
Right, so not too far away. This reminds me that the 1918 flu started at Fort Riley, Kansas on March 11th after the base burned huge quantities of horse manure. It brought back my memory to that. I've often suspected that the respiratory illnesses suffered by those soldiers weren't influenza, but were exposure to partially, poorly burned products. Because what you're describing, there's no way that the chemicals, the rubber, the plastic, probably, half-empty cans of paint, things like that, there's no way that the combustion will be complete, right? You're not getting down to CO2 and water vapor and stuff like that. You're going to have lots of products of partial combustion in the smoke.
Yeah, they're actually burning the waste at too low temperatures and too slowly.
Right.
So they were supposed to put in incinerators. There actually had been a budget for incinerators. Incinerators will burn waste at much higher temperatures,
right,
and produce very, very tiny particles in the air. But in many cases, the incinerators were not ordered. Sometimes they were ordered and they were placed on bases, but they were never used. And there was tens of millions of dollars that were allocated for incinerators, but the money just disappeared and nobody really knows what happened to it.
A lot of money disappeared on during the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Billions of dollars disappeared. I guess this was just small potatoes, but probably somebody walked off with the money instead of in lieu of the incinerators. What made you interested in following up on this story?
Well, I actually read a book a couple of years ago. I'm just sort of a nonfiction fan. That's the genre that I read, and I don't even remember exactly where anymore, but I stumbled upon this book by Joseph Hickman called The Burn Pits. And it seemed like something that I would be interested in reading. And I was just shocked as I started going through the book for a number of reasons. One, because I'd never heard of this before. I don't know anybody in the military. I'm not involved with the military. So it's not really something that I would be aware of. The media doesn't really do a whole lot of coverage about it. So you'd have to kind of stumble upon it if you were to learn anything about it. And it just also, maybe naively, I'm in my mid-50s, but I still was just shocked that this kind of thing could happen, this kind of abuse, this kind of denial. And I just thought, there's a whole audience that doesn't read anymore or that can be reached through the medium that I work in, which is, television and film. And I thought, well, I got to try to do something to try to inform people that this is happening and maybe some good will come of it.
And I should say you've produced a film, which is the reason I'm interviewing you. So what's the title of the film and is it available for people to see it?
The film is called Delay, Deny, Hope You Die. And we are at the moment doing a tour of cinemas in the U.S. We've done about 5 or 6, I think, so far, and we have another 5 or 6 to go. But we're actually doing, and we have a special offer coming up on November 11, which is Veterans Day in the U.S. So normally you wouldn't release the film digitally while it's still in the cinema, but I'm going to make an exception briefly for Veterans Day this year. So people can actually go online and pre-order the documentary now, and then they can watch it anytime during Veterans Day weekend.
Oh, okay. And then if they pre-order it, then they will get full access to it after it's released fully? So on November 12th, they can't watch it. Is that what you're saying? Or
yeah, they can pre-order it now at a discount. It's only going to be about $5. Mm-hmm. If they go to Vimeo.com/on-demand/burnpits, they can actually order it now. And then it will automatically become available on November 11th. And they'll actually have a 48-hour window in which they can watch it. And then it won't be available digitally until next year when our cinema run is finished. So this is a special offer we're doing to honor veterans on this day.
Okay. Thank you for that. And we'll include a link to that in the show notes. But what particularly, there's a lot of terrible things that have happened in the world. I mean, even if you're just looking at terrible things that have happened to soldiers, there's a lot of things like we've covered some of the vaccines, including the anthrax vaccine. We've covered the use of methylquine, the anti-malaria drug that can cause PTSD symptoms and psychosis, things like that. So what kind of grabbed you about this particular story?
Well, I mean, you're right. This thing is not new. I mean, it's not even something that's limited to the military. I mean, there's all kinds of stories of people abusing power, whether it's companies, you know, polluting rivers or the pharmaceutical companies and all that kind of stuff. It's just the truth of the matter is that I've worked in television for a long time, and I used to produce and direct, and I kind of got out of that for a while and got more into management. So I was, the last 10 or 15 years, I've been managing companies.
Right.
And I was looking for a project to get back into production. I wanted to kind of get back to my roots. So I was looking for something to do, but I didn't want to do, you know, light entertainment, game shows, quiz shows. I really wanted to do something that maybe could make a difference. Maybe that's a product of getting older. You feel like you want to use the talents and skills you have to really try to make a difference in the world. And so it was just at a time in my life where I was looking for something like this, and this just really struck me. And then when I started, so I started to do a little bit of research, and I started to talk to some of the people. And of course, you know, now that I'm in my mid-50s, a lot of the people that I talk to are very young. I mean, they're in their 30s, early 30s. So they, you know, in theory, they could be my kids, you know, but there's,
right.
when you're 57, 30 seems young.
Right.
And it's a lot of these young people who kind of believe that they were doing the right thing, because when you join the military, you don't do it for fame and fortune. You know, you're not getting paid anything. So whether you believe in the military or not, whether you, you know, I personally wish we didn't need military. I wish people could get along. But
right.
These people believe they were doing the right thing. It was really, they felt a calling. And so they go overseas for very little money. They give of themselves because they believe it's the right thing to do. They believe in service for the country. And then they come back and they're sort of ignored. And that's something that I just felt I had to try to correct.
Right, and I think that's true of not just the U.S. military, but whether you come back with PTSD or suffering from the, you know, what they called Gulf War Syndrome, which may have been due to the vaccines and other things that they were exposed to, they don't really want to know about you. They might give you an antidepressant or something, and that's about the extent of it. So what are some of the health consequences that some of these soldiers who were in the prime of their life when they went overseas are suffering from?
Well, in many cases, it started when they were in country. They knew that something was going on. They would have ear, nose, and throat issues. They talk about how their throat would actually burn. It was a stinky, nasty kind of smell that you could actually feel in your nose and feel in your throat. So there were a lot of throat issues and nose issues. They actually spoke of something they called the Iraqi crud, for example, where they were actually told, you know, when you come over there, you're going to get sick, get used to it, face it. And so they, you know, some of them would be in and out of the infirmary the entire time that they were deployed, not really with serious issues, but just a lot of long-term kind of irritating issues. But a lot of the problems started to come to light when they would come home.
Right.
Some people would have respiratory issues, respiratory issues that could only be discovered upon having biopsies, rare forms of cancers, vomiting, diarrhea, migraine, headaches, bone lesions, just really the whole scope of medical issues that you can imagine. Some are mild. There are many soldiers that just, I don't want to say just, but have respiratory issues or throat problems or sleep apnea or things
right.
that they can, in theory, live with, but they're very, very limiting.
Mm-hmm.
But there are people who have rare forms of cancers.
I mean, one guy in particular in your video is so thin that you just by looking at him, you know that he's sick, probably dying.
Yeah, that's Daniel Alvarado. He lives just outside of Los Angeles. He's in the documentary. I actually saw him a couple of weeks ago at the premiere in Los Angeles. And, you know, in the documentary, we do kind of a shot where you see him when he first came home, and he was this broad, strong, good-looking guy. And mm-hmm. then, as you said, when you see him now, he's basically a walking skeleton. He has a tracheostomy. He can't speak. He has a feeding tube. He can't eat. He weighs about 75 to 80 pounds. He has cancer. He has hyperthyroidism. He has multiple diseases. And it's not rare. There were people that I was going to speak to for the documentary who eventually couldn't speak to me because they were so sick. A couple of them had passed away since the documentary came out. They wanted to participate, but they were too sick. So it's just horrible.
And I mean, with that kind of illness, even if Veterans Affairs really wanted to, there's not a lot that they can do when somebody's body is such a mess, right? I mean, our medical system can't undo this kind of damage.
No, I mean, there are some people who are too far gone that treatment won't be of any help. But in the case of Daniel Alvarado, for example, the Veterans Administration in the U.S. won't even provide him with the liquid food that he needs. So he has to have, obviously, special food for his feeding tubes. He can't pay for it on his own. He has to rely on donations or, you know, his wife is able to work, but they're not wealthy by any means. But so there are still some things that they could be doing for soldiers now to at least improve the quality of their life.
Right. I didn't mean to say that you know, these people were going to die anyway, so there's nothing they should do. What I'm saying is that they can't be cured.
No.
Obviously, their remaining life should be made as comfortable as possible. And it seems like Veterans Affairs has let down a lot of soldiers over the years. I mean, that's awful that somebody who's suffering so badly would then have the financial costs of staying alive on top of the suffering.
There's another man in the documentary who actually has multiple forms of cancer, and he's about $250,000 in debt because he can't get the treatment that he needs through the VA. So he's bankrupt, and that those are not isolated cases.
Yes, we get onto the whole issue of the healthcare system in the United States. I mean, Veterans Affairs is supposed to be like national healthcare for soldiers, but you're saying that it's failing them.
Well, part of the problem is that if you become ill after you left service, a year after you left service, you have to prove it's service related. So it's not so that the VA is there for all soldiers regardless.
Mm.
It's there for soldiers who have service related injuries or diseases.
Right.
So in the case of the Alvarados, for example, he didn't start getting sick until after he left the service because he has cancer. You don't get cancer in a day. Cancer takes
If you're exposed to a carcinogen today, it's not going to be tomorrow that you show symptoms. I mean, you might have cancer inside you, but until it gets big enough to start screwing up your body, nobody's going to notice.
Right, and then go back and they say, okay, you know, you've got cancer. Prove that it's a result of your exposure to the burn pits. Well, in many cases, it wasn't even just a year. I mean, by the time he was diagnosed, it was a couple years further. You're not in Iraq and Afghanistan anymore. You don't have any kind of physical proof because you're not there. Although he did have private doctors, in Brian's case, who said that the kind of cancer he had could only come from toxic exposure. Okay, but that's still sort of a general term. Prove that the toxic exposure came from the burn pits.
Right.
It was difficult for just an individual who's now struggling to stay alive. His first priority is to become healthy. And, you know, he's being told you've got to prove that, you know, you got the disease from a certain location. And that's what a lot of soldiers are dealing with right now.
I mean, that was a big struggle with Gulf War syndrome. Is at first, for a long time, it was dismissed by the U.S. military, and it was only extensive lobbying by a large number of soldiers and their supporters that actually got it accepted as a condition. And I guess what you're saying is the importance of that is if the military accepted that the burn pits were dangerous, then anybody exposed to them would obviously have a military-related injury. But as long as they deny that this is the case. They don't have to. They don't have to help anybody.
But the thing is, they knew they were dangerous because I've seen a memo written in 2006. The Air Force conducted their own internal study, and it says clearly on that memo, the burn pits are going to be hazardous to the health of soldiers. And the U.S. military just buried that memo. It didn't come out for many, many years. It was finally leaked. So they knew as far back as 2006 that the burn pits were going to be causing health issues to the soldiers, and they chose to ignore it.
Somehow this doesn't surprise me. It's a natural bureaucratic reaction. Yeah. We have a major problem that could be very costly. Where do we bury the body?
And it just gets worse because in some cases, a company called Halliburton, which you've probably heard of, was responsible for managing the burn. I mean, it gets really irritating when you get the whole story. They were given a no-bid contract by former Vice President Dick Cheney, who used to be CEO of Halliburton, to manage several projects on military bases, and one of them was burn pits in certain areas. Halliburton farmed that out to a subsidiary company called Kellogg Brown & Root, which used to be one of their daughter companies.
Right.
Yeah, they're now known as KBR.
Yeah, I've heard of them too.
Sorry?
I've heard of them too.
Yeah. So they were responsible for managing the burn pits in many places. And they were obligated to do this according to U.S. Environmental Protection Agency regulations. I've seen the contracts. Meaning they weren't allowed to burn certain things that the EPA had banned in the U.S. It was supposed to be a little piece of the U.S. in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right.
But we know that they violated the contract because they burned things. We have pictures of it. We have testimony. We have videos of it. We know that they burned things that were illegal. So they violated the terms of the agreement with the U.S. military. But Dick Cheney, in all his wisdom, while he gave them a no-bid contract in the first place, he also gave them an indemnification. So there is a lawsuit pending now between soldiers and KBR. Been going on for years. There's no resolution currently. But the bottom line is it doesn't really matter if KBR is found guilty, because if they have to pay fines, they're not going to be obligated to pay it because they have this indemnification. It's going to be the U.S. taxpayers that ultimately have to pay the bill. So it's just, I mean, the story gets worse and worse the deeper you get into it.
I mean, it should be the U.S. taxpayers paying for the health care anyway. The system is so messed up because you've got people who are sick and they should be looked after no matter what the cause of the sickness. But it's even worse when it's their own government that caused the sickness. One question I had was, like, I can't imagine that there were too many soldiers who said, I want to go to Iraq and shovel garbage. You know, I'm sure they all had a vision of doing something more significant and more military-oriented. So how did some of these soldiers get stuck dumping garbage? Obviously, somebody's got to do it, but were there any characteristics of these soldiers that ended up with them more exposed to the burn pits than other soldiers?
No, because it wasn't necessarily people who actually worked in the burn pits who are sicker than anybody else. There were people whose job it was, you're right, to either shovel stuff into the burn pits, throw stuff in the burn pits, manage it in some way. In some cases, they actually were responsible for picking up garbage trucks full of garbage and driving it into the burn pits. So they were, in theory, more exposed to anybody else. But the fact is, the people anywhere on the base were exposed to these falling ash. And the only characteristic really is that most of the illnesses were coming from five bases in Iraq. There's about 250 burn pits spread out across Iraq and Afghanistan. And most of the illnesses were coming from these five bases. And this is another part of the story that you just blows your mind. And these were the five bases that were built on old chemical weapons storage facilities that Saddam Hussein used to have. So, there's actually a quote in the documentary by Joe Hickman, who wrote the book I mentioned earlier, who appears in the documentary, who said he spoke to people who worked with KBR, who were responsible for putting in the burn pits, who admitted to him that they knew the ground was hot. They knew it was contaminated from these old chemical weapons facilities. But they put burn pits in there anyway. So not only are you burning waste, which are using jet fuel, which, by the way, releases benzene, which is a carcinogen in itself, and you're doing it on top of contaminated dirt. So the whole thing is just, it's almost too ridiculous for war. I mean, it's the kind of thing that if you saw this in a movie, and the movie was about people getting sick, you would think this would never happen because nobody would be so stupid. But it did happen.
Yeah, I mean, you can exactly understand how it is. Like, some bureaucrat says, it would save us money to put our base on what was previously a base. And then somebody says, yes, but it was a base for chemical weapons. And it's like, so what? And then somebody says, well, we're going to need to burn garbage. And it's like, oops, how are we going to burn garbage on a base where all the soil is contaminated? You would have to go well off the base to burn garbage, which isn't possible. So just everybody shut up and do it.
Well, supposedly, you know, this is how they get around. They say supposedly the burn pits were temporary. They were just going to be used while we were putting in these incinerators. But as I mentioned earlier, in many cases, incinerators didn't come, or they did come and they just sat there. I've seen pictures of incinerators surrounded by garbage. So the incinerator is just sitting there. It looks brand new. It looks clean. It's obviously not being used, but around it, the fires are raging. So, how do you explain that?
Yes, the insanity of bureaucracy is impossible to explain. Were the people who worked on the burn pits given protective gear, like face masks or anything like that?
No.
Nothing.
That's an easy question. They were giving nothing. I mean, I have seen pictures with people in bulldozers, for example, who were shoveling garbage into the fires, and they have like those surgical masks that you see. So it looks like that they just grabbed something haphazardly from the infirmary and put it on themselves. It's certainly nothing that looks
like those little paper masks.
Which
of course protect a little bit about against particles, but not against any of the gases.
No. They were issued gas masks, but those were, you know, more for chemical or biological weapons or attacks that may come. But there was no protection offered for any of the soldiers. I mean, because it was, as I said, it was just like a cloud that hung over the base all the time. So they just went about their business. You know, I asked soldiers, didn't you complain? I mean, you must know that this is not normal. This is not healthy. And most of the time they didn't even complain. They just thought, well, you know, we have to do it. Some of them said, we were told it was not hazardous. We didn't believe our government would do this to poison us, so we believed it must be okay. A few did complain, and basically they were told to just shut up and do their job.
Yeah, that's sort of classic. I mean, it reminds me of the Agent Orange, the use of Agent Orange during Vietnam, where soldiers would lie to about that.
A lot of them are comparing this to Agent Orange. They're afraid that this is going to become their generation's Agent Orange, because as you know, I mean, there are still cases pending from Agent Orange, you know, what is it now, 40 years ago. The problem with the burn pits is that a lot of the soldiers are dying much more quickly. So a lot of them won't be around in 40 years. That's where the title of the documentary comes from. One of the soldiers in the documentary talks about how the VA's new motto should be delay, deny, hope you die, because they're just sitting around waiting for the solution to come, which will be that people just disappear.
Yes, which probably won't happen, because although some will be so sick they will die quickly, others will go on for years with chronic illness. And it's amazing how hard people can struggle when they feel that themselves and their comrades have been abused. It's not just about them. I mean, one of the things the military does build is a camaraderie between soldiers. And even after they come back from wars, they often stick together. So,
well, that's what a lot of the people were saying to me. A lot of people feel like whatever happens with this documentary or with awareness in general or with the lawsuit that's pending or whatever might happen, it's probably too late for the people that are exposed now. Certainly, like as you said earlier, many people can't be cured. They have a disease. Maybe their quality of life can be improved, but they can't be saved So any change that's going to happen is going to be for the future comrades. And so they're hoping, although, as we've mentioned, you know, this kind of thing has been going on for decades. There's something about the way the military treats its own. I don't really understand it. But when they come back home, whether it's Gulf War syndrome or going back even further to Agent Orange, they're sort of abandoned. And there has to be a real change in the way the military is viewed. As I said, you know, they don't do this for money. They do it because of their honor.
Right.
And I don't know why they're treated this way when they come home. They somehow this has to change for the future. And
Well, I mean, it's not just the military. I think all of society, you know, loves to see soldiers on parade, loves to hear stories about the bravery of their own soldiers. There's sort of a narrative that's a good narrative about the military, but there's a dirty side. I mean, if it's not the abuse of the soldiers, it's things like the soldiers creating war crimes put into a situation where this kind of thing is inevitable. And those are the stories that nobody really wants to hear because it wrecks the narrative. And I guess for people who haven't been over there, it's hard to understand, and there's not much motivation to try to understand because it's can be very unsettling.
If you go to an American sporting event, for example, or whatever, military veterans are often honored, and people seem to have kind of a superficial respect for soldiers, but it's not really exemplified in any kind of public policy, like you said. You know, I mean, to me, okay, I'm American, but I've lived in Europe now for 30 years, so I've experienced, you know, what Americans would call socialized medicine, what we just call universal healthcare. And
right.
Of course, when I first came over here, it was strange to me, and it was different. And what do you mean everybody has insurance? Well, everybody has insurance, and everybody's covered. And you know, I don't know really anymore why Americans have this issue that divides them so much. But it seems to me that if you serve in the military, if somebody's risking your life, as I said, they're not doing it for money. So one way they could be rewarded is, you know, okay, we'll give you healthcare when you come back, at least. You know, they have plans for education so military can go to school and get trained when they come back home and things like that. Why not just simply say, that's what kind of baffles me. Does it really matter if this is caused by the burn pits or not? Why don't you just say, you served in the military, you're going to give up, you know, whatever, years of your life, you're going to put yourself in a dangerous situation, and when you come home, since you're not going to become rich by doing this, one of the benefits we will give you is health care. And so whether you have a hangnail or cancer, it doesn't matter. You should be taken care of. And I know that costs money, but the truth of the matter is America has the money. It's just how you allocate the money.
Yeah, they could reduce their military presence in the world a little bit and have lots of money for universal health care, not just the soldiers. I mean, if you're going to give all ex-soldiers in America health care, you may as well give everybody health care because such a large percentage of the population has that. So these five bases, obviously were in Iraq because Afghanistan, I don't believe, ever had chemical weapons. No. So the majority of these soldiers are former are Iraq veterans. The affected soldiers.
Yeah, because the majority of illnesses were coming from these five bases, although, as I said, there was more than 250 burn pits spread out across Iraq and Afghanistan, so there are many sick soldiers who served in that theater, but the majority come from these five bases, including, as a matter of fact, former Vice President Joe Biden's son. He was very healthy when he went. He served in Iraq at Balad, which was famous for having one of the biggest burn pits. It was just gigantic. And fairly soon after he left service, he developed a brain tumor. And he died of that brain tumor. And it's the same kind of cancer that a lot of his war colleagues experienced and died from. So there was never an in-depth investigation, but there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that points that his death could also have been caused by the burn pit.
That's very interesting. Biden, the former vice president, has not questioned the burn pits and in connection with his son's death?
No, I actually reached out to them to see if they would be willing to participate, but of course, that's a very sticky wicket to approach somebody who's...
Yeah, there's rumors that Biden wants to run as president, and so it wouldn't be good to be besmirching the U.S. military if you wanted to become president. I was going to say that if we talk about things like NFL games where there's military veterans on display, I'm sure many of those military veterans are amputees, and I'm sure the audience would assume that the amputation was was due to a wound in the war, an IED, or they got shot, or something like that. It's probably very unlikely that they would think that the amputation was due to an amputation due to a cancer caused by the military exposure, or was due to friendly fire, or things like that. Even if it was, I mean, the military is going to want to show that these soldiers suffered from heroism, not from the consequences of military incompetence or worse.
That's correct. There are many soldiers who didn't want to speak to me at all because they feel a little embarrassed that their illness is not caused by any kind of combat, but it's caused because they slept too close to, you know, a burning fire. So, it kind of does have a stigma attached to it. And part of the problem is that, as I said at the beginning, not a lot of people are familiar with this issue. It hasn't gotten very much coverage by the mainstream media at all. You do sometimes see local stories. As I mentioned, the Alvarados in L.A., there has been a little bit of local coverage. And I've seen stories locally because local media might find this kind of interesting. And hey, there's somebody close to our station or our channel that's experienced it, so they have that local feel to it. But the only thing that you've really ever seen on the networks is just very short, 2-minute stories about, you know, there were burn pits and people are sick, and that's about it. So I mean, literally, if you blink, you miss it. So
right.
A lot of people don't even know that this is even an issue. So if they see, for example, Brian Alvarado, he told me that the response that he gets is that people think he's a crack addict, or because he does look like that. He's very, very skinny and gaunt and weak, and that's what people seem to associate it with. Most people, I found out when I started making this documentary, outside of the military, have no idea that this even exists. I mean, they've never given any thought to what do you do with garbage in the military. Never crossed their mind. Never
right.
crossed their mind. Burn. Never crossed their mind. You can become sick of it. So it's really something that most people just literally don't know anything about.
Well, I had never thought about it. I mean, it's one of those things that's obvious when you're confronted with it. I mean, obviously, the military creates garbage. I just assumed it magically disappeared somehow, like it was trucked to a big dump.
I actually talked to a couple people who were older, because it occurred to me, well, what did you do in the Vietnam War with the garbage? And they say, well, you know, we've become a disposable society now. Part of the problem is that in the Vietnam War, and when you think of war movies or something, when you think, oh, yeah, remember, they used to have their little kit. They would have their little pots and pans and their spoons. And their little metal glasses, and you know, they would carry water with them, and they would refill it, and things like this. You're like, oh yeah. Now they say we live in a disposable society, so everything that we make, for example, he told me he drank about 10 to 20 bottles of water per day, because obviously it's 120 degrees in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Now, multiply 20 bottles of water times 20,000, because you know that's how many people are on the base.
Right.
Just the sheer number of water bottles that you have to dispose, which is plastic, of course, all thrown into a pit. And so he says part of it is because of the society we live in now. We don't, you know, he said we don't have a lot of metal plates anymore. Plates were plastic. We just threw everything away.
Okay. So the consequence of a completely disposable society. So you have a plastic plate, plastic knife and fork, plastic cup to drink with, plastic water bottles. And just gets thrown in a garbage bin, which disappears and ends up in the burn pits.
And we're not even talking about, I mean, this is a whole nother story, but we're not even talking about the local population, because I've seen videos of local Iraqis, for example. They would sneak into the burn pits because, of course, one person's garbage is another man's treasure, right? Because there would be all right. kinds of things, because there was, you know, sometimes, I mean, I've seen video of this stuff, so I've seen that it's happened. Sometimes they would, U.S. military would order something, let's say material, to build whatever, and they might have too much of it. They would just throw it away. So it would be,
right.
So you're talking about just excess waste. Well, a lot of the, you know, Iraqis would live around the base. They would come in because they can use this either for themselves or to sell it or whatever. But the smoke and the ash of the burn pits doesn't stop at this invisible wall surrounding the base. It goes out into the local community. And there are now reports of Iraqi children being born with higher rates of cancer and other diseases. And that's, I mean, that's a whole nother story that people don't think about. And we're certainly not going to do anything to help them, are we?
Yeah. No. I mean, that's sort of typical of military coverage. Americans know exactly how many soldiers died in Iraq, but nobody has any idea of how many civilians, except that it's a much larger number.
It's collateral damage, right? Too bad.
Yes. I mean, it seems to me this is also part of the consequence of the privatization of war, which really took off with the Iraq War. I mean, if you're Halliburton or KBR, your aim is to make as much money as possible. So that what means you want to get the biggest contract possible for which you have to do the least amount of work. So if you can cut corners, that directly goes to your profit. And that's not to say the military hasn't done lots of bad things in the past, but now you have a really big financial incentive to say, if we continue to operate the burn pits, maybe it's a whole lot cheaper than if we fire up the incinerator.
Exactly. And if you have an indemnification, then it doesn't really matter if what you're doing is legal or illegal or causing harm to soldiers or not, because there's not going to be any penalty.
Or if your best friend is Dick Cheney or somebody like that.
Yeah, the lawyer who represents, or one of the lawyers who represents soldiers in the case against KBR, actually now has a full-time job suing KBR, because management of the burn pits was just one thing they were supposed to do. They were supposed to do electricity, for example, and they ended up electrocuting soldiers in the showers.
I heard about this.
Yeah, so they're being sued for that. They poisoned the water. They're being sued for that. So, I mean, they committed so many, I'll use the word crimes, because they were certainly crimes against humanity, in so many different areas. And ultimately, they're not even going to be responsible. I have a guy in the documentary who worked for KBR, and he feels guilty because he's one of the people that would throw some of this stuff into the burn pits. So he knew exactly what they were doing, and he worked with KBR. He went to KBR, and he said, "We have to stop this." And he was threatened with his job. He's testified before Congress. Still, it doesn't seem to do any good.
Because the most important thing is their profits. Yeah. And something like this could cause them to have to put a lot of money into improving waste disposal so it wasn't toxic, and that again is money that's coming off their bottom line.
And they blame everything on the military. They say, "We were just doing what the military told us to do," even though, as I said, I've seen contracts where they weren't supposed to burn certain materials, even though I've spoken to people who worked for KBR and said I didn't see any military supervision. Most of the time, it was the other way around. It was KBR telling the military what to do. So it's all just a scam, really.
Yeah, and I mean, what were you supposed to do if there were things you weren't supposed to burn? Was there a process in place for disposing of the things that weren't supposed to go into the burn pits?
Well, that's what the incinerators were supposed to be for.
Right.
But obviously, if you don't have an incinerator, and you're not going to put it on a boat and ship it out somehow, and you have no recycling plants, I guess you have no choice except to burn it. And that's kind of the argument that KBR uses. Although there's a senator in the documentary, Tom Udall from New Mexico, who says, "But we allocated money for incinerators." So KBR got the money for the incinerators. Where are the incinerators, number one? And where's the money, number two? And it sort of vanished. Nobody seems to be able to find it.
It seems like it was a big financial feeding frenzy. Billions of dollars were thrown at Iraq, and nobody really seemed to care where it went. As long as the government got overthrown, the rest was just details. And if a lot of those details didn't get covered, and it enriched people who were friends of the U.S. government, you know, inside the Beltway friends, then it's not such a bad thing. That brings in more. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Now it's so late, you can't, you know, people didn't keep records, of course. So now it's so late, you're never going to have answers to any of these things.
Well, I have answers to some of them, but yes, a lot will have been lost in these extensive wars. So in the case of the people, the veterans that you talked to, how long did it take them to connect their illnesses to the burn pit exposure?
Well, that really varied because, ironically, most of them didn't really put two and two together. As I said, some of them were sick when they were there.
Right.
But when you come back home and your nose issues or your throat issues disappear or whatever, and then a year or two goes by, you don't really connect the dots anymore.
Right.
It's only when I'll use the case of the Alvarados again. Brian Alvarado's a young man. He didn't smoke. He didn't drink. And he got cancer in the throat. That's where it started. Well, his doctor says this is really unusual because this is normally a smoker's disease. This is normally a disease that an old man who smokes will get, not a 30-year-old guy in perfect health. So this is really weird to begin with. It mm-hmm. looks like, you know, you're exposed to something, and then they slowly start to put the pieces together. And then over time, there have been these groups of people that have formed, you know, Facebook pages and so forth. They start to meet other people, and they start to do a little bit of research, and they realize, hey, this person has the same kind of a disease or another kind of disease, and they start to realize what's the one thing we had in common, not necessarily that we served in Iraq, but that we served near these burn pits, because we're starting to get diseases that are associated with toxic exposure. Well, the only toxins I was exposed to was the burn pits. So over a period of time, they start to put two and two together, but one of the doctors I spoke to says he thinks that there's probably tens of thousands of soldiers out there that are sick and don't really connect it to the burn pits. I have messages sometimes on my own Facebook page that people will put in and they'll say, I never thought about the burn pits anymore. I have this. I have sleep apnea, or I have whatever the case may be, and migraines, or, you know, I have cancer. And I never thought it was the burn pit. This is the first time I'm really thinking about it. And we're, you know, 10 or 15 years down the road. So who knows how many people are really sick. There is a registry. The government set up a registry. So if you feel like your illness came because of the burn pit, you can go on and you can put your name. And there's about 100,000 people who have put their name on it so far.
So right. I'll get that link from you so that if anybody's listening to this knows a soldier who is overseas with the U.S. military and is suffering potential consequences, they could...
Although the registry in itself is flawed, because if you were...
I'm shocked. I'm absolutely shocked.
Well, for example, if you were a contractor, so you worked for KBR or another contractor, for example, not even with the burn pits, but if you were just there for some other some other reason, and you believe you're ill because of the burn pits, you can't register because you weren't a member of the military. So that leaves out thousands and thousands of, you know, private individuals who served over there.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of this consequence of privatization. I mean, Halliburton gets a contract. They download it onto a subsidiary. The subsidiary hires a company from India or Chile or something like that. And now you have people earning basically less than minimum wage. And if something happens to them after they go home, nobody's even going to know who they are. Let alone connect it, let alone want to compensate them for anything.
And some of the contractors were Iraqi. Some of them were locals.
Right.
They're long gone. Plus, if you have passed away and your wife, your husband, your father, whatever, your brother wants to put you on the list because they just want to get information. They want to be, you can't. So if you're deceased, you can't go on the list. If you're a contractor, you can't go on the list. So that excludes, you know, probably 2/3 of the people that were exposed anyway. So, I mean, it's a start, and I suppose a start is a good thing, but it's flawed.
Well, yes, but the more people who who register, the more pressure there will be on the military. I mean, I would imagine maybe 10 years from now, the military will finally admit that this was a problem and will start compensating people. But as you say, by then, so many of them will have will have died, and a lot of people will never connect the fact that 10 years after their service in Iraq that they came down with cancer, people not connect to that, not even think that it could be connected to.
And some people don't have the time. I've spoke to people who were sick, and they just said, look, you know, you might be right. I might be screwed by the government, and it might be all their fault, but I can't put any effort into that because I have to get better. So there's a whole lot of people that just sort of have given up on that side of it and are just trying, you know, fighting to stay alive.
Yes. Well, it's a fascinating and it's a concerning story. I mean, it's part of the cost of war, and these indirect costs are significant. And especially in America, with so many soldiers coming back physically or emotionally damaged, and now in this case, the damage is not when they're on the plane home. It's not obvious when they're on the plane home. It might be years later. And yet, it still really is a cost of war that the government doesn't really have to bear, because they're going to leave these people on their own, and unless they can persuade the government that it's connected to Iraq, which is unlikely, unless maybe after years of pressure from these veterans, the government and maybe some assistance from members of Congress and senators, maybe eventually the military will be forced to admit that, yes, the burn pits were a hazard, and anybody who was exposed to the burn pits deserves compensation.
Well, I hope that, you know, the documentary can help in some way, because I think the change is going to have to come from outside. And I've been to some of the screenings that we're having, and the reactions of the audience members, you know, as a filmmaker is encouraging, because, you know, the end of the film is always met with deathly silence, and you know, you see people crying, you see people mad and angry and shocked and bewildered and upset. So I hope that people will go out and they'll see screenings on my Facebook page. They can see a list of all the screenings that are happening, and we've got, as I said, this special offer through Vimeo for Veterans Day. Maybe people can spread the word and are willing to spend a couple bucks so they can stream the documentary and share it with people. And I mean, if we get lucky and this goes viral, then, you know, very quickly, that's the power of the internet. You could have tens of thousands or literally hundreds of thousands of people who see this documentary, and literally within, you know, a period of a couple weeks, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of more people can become aware about this who weren't previously.
Yes, and especially the youth of America, who are currently exposed, pardon me, to a lot of pro-military propaganda, for example, at NFL games, which always has this sort of heroic narrative that if you do go overseas and something bad happens to you, you will be looked after, and the cause of that injury or death will be your heroism, not the incompetence and lack of care of the government, and that you might die from being exposed to garbage rather than an IED. I think, a lot of veterans, after they come back in their 30s, 40s, 50s, or older, they realize they were lied to a lot, but it's the 15 and 20-year-olds who are still buying the shiny narrative that's being sold to them.
Yeah, I mean, it's obvious, you know, when you come home without an arm or something, or most of the time that, you know, something happened to you, and most of the time in those cases you are taken care of, because it's clear that your injury is,
right,
is service related. But you're right, it's ironic now that they denied PTSD, and what's happening now to a lot of soldiers with the burn pits is that they're saying, well, a lot of the illnesses that you have, a lot of the problems that you have are mental illnesses. So now it's sort of like they're coming back around and they're saying, well, you don't have real physical problems anymore. Because in the case of the lung issues, for example, there was no normal testing that revealed that they had actual lung problems. They actually had to conduct biopsies. So the military would tell them, well, you know, I'm having trouble breathing. Yeah, well, that's stress, or it's something mental. So they would blame it on some kind of psychosomatic issue.
Especially if you're drinking or smoking, then they can blame it on that.
And there was a doctor at Vanderbilt University who, he was actually getting patients from the military, because the military would say, okay, well, you know, go get it checked out. And he would do normal pulmonary function tests and stress tests and that kind of thing, but he couldn't find anything. And finally he did a lung biopsy, which is a really heavy, invasive kind of
operation. Right, it's not pleasant.
No. And then he found the true cause was, I mean, they would find pieces of metal in the lungs.
Oh, my God.
He went back to the military, and the military stopped sending him patients. That's how you solve that problem.
Exactly. That's a classic solution to an embarrassing problem. Just stop looking. Don't ask the questions when you know you won't like the answer.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've gone through most of our time, so I'm just wondering if there are any last thoughts or comments you'd like to make before we finish up.
Well, I just would hope that people will watch the documentary and spread the word about the documentary. As I said, you can find it on Vimeo, which is Vimeo/on-demand/burn pits. You can pre-order it now. You can watch it on Veterans Day weekend if you can't get to a screening near you, and really especially spread the word. Tell everybody to go to Vimeo and tell everybody to pre-order it and watch it and share it. And like I said, suddenly within a couple weeks period, I mean, we could be talking again in a month from now, and suddenly hundreds of thousands of people could be aware of what's going on, and then maybe real change will come. So that's what I'd like to leave the people with, is that, you know, one of the things about America that's still great is that the people do have power. People still can enact change. Mm-hmm. But you have to be aware of what's happening. You first have to have knowledge. So watch the documentary, spread word about the documentary, get the information, and then maybe we can help these people who deserve it.
Yes, I mean, the military contractors are a very powerful force, but they're not immune from pressure if the pressure is great enough. Tens of thousands of people getting together to fight something like this can make a change. And I think no matter what people think about the military, there's obviously a lot of people who question why America's involved in so many wars overseas. It's not the soldiers who created those wars. And many of them, as you said, go over with very idealistic ideas about what they're going to be able to accomplish, that they're actually going to make America safer. They truly believe this. So they definitely deserve the support of the population when they come back sick.
I agree.
Well, thank you very much for joining me today. I really appreciate
Okay, no problem. I hope that, as I said, that people will watch the documentary, spread the word, and, you know, let's see if we can make a difference.
Yes, good luck with that, and this is coming out a few days before Veterans Day, so people have time to go and purchase the download and watch it on November the 11th.
Thank you very much.
Okay, goodbye. Thank you for listening to episode 160 of The Infectious Myth. Please consider a monthly donation at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.